I think that's it for immediate announcements. Labyrinth's friends David. David's with us this morning. Would you mind just stand up and introduce yourself, David?
David Alexander. I've known Lambert a little over 20 years now.
Welcome. We can applaud to welcome David this morning. Anybody else first time in the class? We just want you to, if you're too shy, just know that you're welcome. Maybe too shy, maybe just, that's just the way you roll. I don't know. But we're glad you're with us. Without further ado, Lambert, come on up.
Okay.
Oh, Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thought afar off. You comprehend my path and my lying down. You are acquainted with all my ways, for there is not a word on my tongue. But behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You have hedged me behind and before, and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain to it. Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uppermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall behold to hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall fall on me, even the night shall be light about me, even the darkness shall not hide from you, for the night shines as the day, the darkness and the light are both alike to you. For you formed in my inward parts, you covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they all were written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God, how great is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would be more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. You torment, therefore, you bloodthirsty men. For they speak against you wickedly. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate them, O Lord, who hate you? Do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, and know my anxieties. And see if there is any wicked way in me. And lead me in the way everlasting.
Thank you, Bob, very much. That's beautifully read, isn't it? Just by way of a quick review, last week we did a very cursory run through Psalm 77. There are five sermons on Psalm 77 on Ray Sedman's website. I took the time to listen to all of them last week. realized how little I had said about the psalm in class and how worthwhile it is to dig into that one psalm with a little more thoroughness and depth. You remember that's the psalm about a man who's distressed and distraught because God isn't answering his prayers, and he gets in this big emotional snit and things get worse and worse, and till finally he comes to his senses and begins to look at the God who he knows and discovers that God has not left him, and that God's plan is on track. So that, just don't miss the depths of that psalm. This week I talked to several people about the psalm, and it turned out it was a favorite psalm of several people that I ran onto. Steve's message on Psalm 16 is on my website, and it's really excellent. I got a lot out of that, Steve. That was good. If you have a psalm that you think we should pay attention to, I started out making a list of psalms to go through, and then I sort of half gave up on that. If you have a favorite psalm, would you drop me an email or come and see me? And the other thing would be that if you're passionate about your favorite psalm, you probably should come and teach it, so that the weight of it comes through. And I think that would be good. All right, now let's look at this particular psalm by David. Oh, there was another question last week on Asaph, who wrote the Psalm 77. Asaph wrote 12 psalms, number 50, numbers 73 to 83. I found it instructive just to read through all of the psalms that are attributed to Asaph. We don't know a lot about the man. He evidently was a Levitical priest in the time of King David. This would have been just before the Temple of Solomon was built, but David had set the tabernacle up in Jerusalem, and he had put the Levitical priests to work in the sacrifices and in the temple services. Part of the temple services was music. These psalms were all sung, and they had Levites that were assigned in various courses or groups to conduct the service of the day, and it would involve the psalms. But just reading through the Psalms of Asaph, I could see what a godly man this was, and his uniqueness comes through when you've read the whole collection of his psalms. Okay, Psalm 139. Psalm of David. It's one of eight psalms that comes in a row here. I don't know when this took place in David's life, but it begins, of course, with profound thanksgiving from David. I will give thanks, O Lord, O Jehovah, O Yahweh, personal name of God, intimate covenant name of God. I will give thanks, O Lord, with my whole heart. Before the gods I sing thy praise. I bow down before thy holy temple and give thanks to thy name for the...
That's 138.
You started one early.
Did, didn't I? You know, I've done that a few times in here. Sometimes I read it upside down and backwards. Well, that's a good psalm, but I won't do it today. Thank you. O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest when I sit down and when I rise up. Is that the right one? Thou discernest my thoughts from afar. Thou searchest out my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Thou dost beset me behind and before, and layest thy hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for to me. It is high, I cannot attain it. What is it that's primary, number one, in his focus? What's he thinking about? About God. And this, we got to have some discussion here so that it gets livened up a little bit. We want a Holy Ghost revival before we're done here, you know. We need something like that, okay? What's on his mind about God?
The omnipresence.
The omnipresence of God and the omniscience of God. God is everywhere, and God knows everything. Is there anything that you could teach God that he doesn't already know?
No.
This is pretty staggering, and this is well worth thinking about a little bit, about a God who knows everything there is to know about you and about me and about us and about the past and the future and the rest of the universe. And that knowledge is always right in front of him here and now. So it's kind of interesting that he knows me so thoroughly, far better than I know myself. And simultaneously, he knows each and every one of you just as well, just as intimately, just as personally. I haven't got a clue what you guys are thinking about, hardly. I frown or smile once in a while, but and God's got this in his constant updated database right now. He's keeping track of everything that you've ever thought and ever done, everything that's on your mind. He's got exhaustive knowledge about everything. Now, if you had the wrong God, that might be a very frightening, scary thing. If you had a God who was a tyrant and a usurper and selfish and out to get you, out to destroy you, you don't want that bad kind of a God to know too much. You want to keep secrets just for your own protection. Part of the thing that shows up in this psalm about intimacy with God is who God is. What kind of a God is it that we're talking about? This is not Allah. Allah is not a personal God. Allah is whimsical. He has said to be merciful, but you can't be sure. You don't know. This is not Buddha. Actually, Buddha didn't believe in a deity. He believed simply in a state of being where you kind of came to know yourself, but there's no active agent behind Buddha's idea of God. People worship the God of Buddha, but Buddha wasn't himself a religious man. And how about Hinduism? Hinduism sounds like good because everything is God in Hinduism. This is sum total of all things is what constitutes God. But if you go to India and you see how this works out in practice, every village has got its own deity. They parade the big statues through the towns all the time, and the deities change from village to village because the all-knowing God, who's the ground of our being, can take many manifestations and show up in many forms. And they can be contradictory forms. No way in Hinduism to differentiate between good and evil, because they're all coming from the same source. And so right away, the thing this psalm should do for us is to get us to stop and think about God. Now, God's all-knowing, and he is omnipresent. Omnipresent means that out on the planet Mars right now, God knows everything that's going on up there with the Martians, with the canals, and with whatever's going on with the space rovers. It doesn't matter how far away something is. He has full, complete knowledge of that right now. Has full, complete knowledge of what's going on in 7 billion people on the earth right now. Does he know the past history of mankind all the way? Does he know all the people living and dead? Does he know what's going on in if people happen to be in hell, made a bunch of bad choices and ended up in hell? Does God have intimate knowledge of how to unwrap the judgments against people in hell one by one and not miss anything? That'd be the scary side, wouldn't it? To have a judge who indicted you and didn't lose track of any details, and the God that had no mercy. If it was the God that had no mercy, what a terrible fate that would be. All right? So the first thing would be to stop and realize that there aren't any secrets from God. That means you can talk to God honestly, candidly, frankly, in ordinary English. He reads your thoughts. He knows all the things in your life that you're ashamed of, that you're afraid to share with anybody. That obvious? Now, if we as Christians believe this about God, that he loves us, that he's all-knowing, should that not make it easier for us to be transparent one with another? If God's the third party in our relationship, it wouldn't behoove us to play games with God, would it? And to get into little arguments between each other, with God being the third party who is there, and he knows perfectly what's true on both sides. That's not going to be we're going to win that one. No, we won't win that one. You know, you've searched me and you've known me. Now, search me means that he knows the very depths of our heart, the unconscious, all the things that we don't know, all the things that we've forgotten, all the things that we don't remember, all the things we haven't done yet. He's got those. He's got knowledge of the future. He discerns my thoughts from afar. He searches my path and my lying down. He's acquainted with all my ways. How about lifestyle, habits, unique glitches that go with my personality, my temperament? Does he know all those things perfectly well? Loves me anyhow, totally. Does this affect his love? No, his love is constant. When you get a question, just yeah, because I want to, our microphone man to have adequate exercise today. Okay. Verse 4, even before a word is on my tongue, lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. God anticipates what your next thought's going to be. He's way ahead of us in the whole day. He's already got the whole day all in the process of being unfolded. You don't have to know all the details. Who's running the whole universe right now? How much influence do you have in the running of the universe, let alone your own life, let alone the lives of your kids or your associates? How much say do you really have? Well, not a lot. Even before a word is on my tongue, Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Thou dost beset me before and behind. You lay your hand upon me. I'm protected. I am protected and guarded against my own weaknesses, against the evil in the world, against the maliciousness of other people. God's taking that into account in his database of his understanding of me. Just incredible. Underneath it, we also know that God is loving and kind and gentle and merciful and just and holy. And without that other set of attributes, it would be very scary to have somebody know as much as God knows about us. So, right, we have a cause already to be very, very thankful that we are privileged to have this super personal, intimate relationship with God. Talk to him about absolutely anything. Share with him from the depths of our heart and find that he already knows all about it and that he's accepting and that he longs for us to communicate. If you don't communicate, it tends to get difficult to live, out of tune with the rest of the universe. He says in verse 7, such knowledge is too wonderful to me, it is high, I cannot attain it. I can't come up to God's level of doing things because he's so much greater and loftier than I am or anybody is. He created the universe. Does he understand quantum mechanics? Does he understand computers? Oh, yes, it's just no big deal at all. And there's nothing he doesn't know. You can't come up to God and say, oh, God, guess what I thought of today that I want to share with you because I know you'll really enjoy this. Well, he does delight when we come and tell him that we've seen something. It's not any real big news to him, but he is delighted because his kids are getting something good out of his benevolent love for us. Personal, loving, intimate God whose heart's desire is for a very personal relationship with him. Our fears, our doubts, our hopes, our joys, the more intimately we share, the better. And the more intimately we share with God, the more intimately we can be with our fellow human being. You notice that? The more you pay attention to God, the more the rest of your life will come into line with what God's like. Instead of reacting the way the world reacts, that you'll start thinking God's thoughts after him, which is all very liberating and helpful. And then he says in verse 7, whither shall I go from thy spirit, or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I was going to hide from you, and I can think back on times in my Christian life when I was trying to hide from God, when I didn't want God finding out my sin, my guilt, my shame, the bad things I'd done, I'm afraid of people and afraid of God. And where in the world do you run to? Little kids go pull the covers over their heads, thinking that that's going to shut out the bad things in life and protect you from mom and dad if they're mad at you. But that doesn't work with the real God, because he knows what. There's no place to run to, because he's everywhere and he knows everything. The psalmist, of course, think of Jonah here. Jonah's this wonderful story of a man who didn't particularly want to go to Nineveh because he didn't like those bad Ninevites. And so he went to Spain off in the meantime. And God knew all of this from the start and said, oh, let's rethink your decision. Maybe you want to go to Nineveh after all. And he did. So the humor, that God has a sense of humor. If I ascend to heaven, thou art there. If I was to go up to heaven today, I would find that God's up there. Well, that's logical. But if I made my bed in Sheol, if I decided that I would rather hide out in hell, Sheol or the grave, then God's there too. So God is in hell. God's running hell. He's maintaining it. I don't think he enjoys it any. I'm sure he doesn't enjoy it. It's painful for him to see this, the eternal destruction of men and women made in his image who refuse his grace and have refused it permanently. And yet God, in his justice, has to let people spend eternity with the consequences of their bad choices. And so God puts up with an enormous amount of pain in dealing with evil people, in order that we could have the bliss and the enjoyment of the positive side of his love. That C.S. Lewis calls hell the backside of God's love. All right. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there thy hand shall lead me and thy right hand shall hold me. Think of here's a soaring like an eagle, or sailing on a fast boat. Think of all the things that people do for adventure and sport and travel to get away from it all. Well, you can get away from maybe the stress at the office, but do you get away from your guilt, your sin? Do you get away from God? No. Changing, be in Hawaii this afternoon, and with all of your problems will go right along with you. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there thy hand will lead me and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, let only darkness cover me and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to thee. The night is bright as the day. Darkness is as light with thee. Isn't it interesting that people who do evil generally arrange to do it at night? The great crimes that go on in the world, all the hanky-panky of secret love affairs that you could get away with in the daytime if you dared, but the light hurts our eyes and we don't like that. We think somehow that nighttime protects us, insulates us, and the psalmist says, no, the dead of night is bright as daylight to God. That's how the world looks. You just imagine turning on the lights in a very dark world and having the secret sins of darkness suddenly brought up into the light, which is what God's going to do with history. He's going to expose all that secret stuff going on. Verse 13. Wonderful little section here about David's examination of his own origin, of his own roots. Thou didst form my inward parts. Thou didst knit me together in my mother's womb. The word there is embroidery. God embroidered me in my mother's womb. Thou didst form my inward parts. Thou didst knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise thee, for thou art fearful and wonderful. Wonderful are thy works. Thou knowest me right well. My frame was not hidden from thee when I was being made in secret, intricately wrought together, knitted together in the depths of the earth. Thy eyes beheld my unformed substance. In thy book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. Now, this is an insight into the time you and I spent in the womb, when God began to put us together, taking a sperm and an ovum and joining them together in two cells and building a unique, incredible human individual out of that very simple beginning. And it's much more complicated than you might imagine. When did David become aware of his own unique identity? In hindsight, not at the time it was happening, he could see all the way back to the very earliest formative years when God was putting him together. This leads you to believe that maybe a human being comes into existence not at birth, but at the time of conception? I would think so. When a human embryo begins to grow, we start with identical cells. They're all the cells are all identical. And for a while, they multiply 2, 4, 8, 16, all identical in the embryo. And then at a certain point, all those cells, each one of them has the full instruction set, those cells stop dividing identically and they begin to differentiate. And a particular cell begins to make bones, and another particular cell begins to make nerves, and another cell decides to make something else. And pretty soon, from that master instruction plan, is coming all of the different kinds of cells in the body. They're all coming in exactly the right timing. Who is doing that? Nobody knows how that happens. David, our medical man, can probably tell us. Yeah.
I was going to say, this sort of, I mean, it gives you a sense of your worth before God and the sense that he doesn't make mistakes.
No mistakes.
There's always a chance you feel like, Lord, why did you make me this way? Or why couldn't I, hit a 95-mile-an-hour fastball and make a lot of money? You know, whatever. But there's no errors in what he's doing.
We are created and we are made, because there's an invisible part of us, which would be soul and spirit. The invisible, intangible part, God creates. He orders it into existence out of nothing. And then David's talking about the body that was built to house the spiritual side. And we know now the body is flawed and failing, but it's still absolutely remarkably built. It's a temporary house. It's a temporary home till we get our permanent home. But how marvelous it is. And God is intervening in every single cell division to make sure that that cell divides and moves towards the purposes for which it's needed in the body. What happens in a computer program when the instructions get messed up? You suddenly get a conflict of one set of instructions that is incompatible with another set of instructions. And conflict resolution is something that computer programmers deal with all day long. When you can't violate one set of instructions, but it's out of this original one kind of cell that all the rest of the cells develop in exactly the right order. And God's doing it. So God's hand is in the development of every single one of us, spiritually and physically, from conception. I think that. This, of course, the whole subject of abortion comes in here, and the huge irresponsibility the human race has had in concern for the unborn, the horrific slaughter of innocents, unique individuals that God intended to bring into the world. What do we have? 30, 40 million abortions in our country now? Something like that? Murdered children. Well, I think here David is giving us, with God's help, an insight into our history. Our history uniquely began with God, and God uniquely involved in every single one of us and all of the differences we have. And once in a while there's a little glitch, but not usually, in the programming. And if there's a little glitch, it'll get fixed in the new body. All right? Verse 16. Thy eyes beheld... Yeah, please.
You know that God is perfect and made this individual. But how would you give an answer to the people that said, I made this way?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I caught
the gay people that say that they were made that way.
Oh, yeah. First of all, the body as we have it now is a fallen body. That's the sin that passed on down to us from Adam. And it's a sin that affects the body, among things. I think most wrong behavior is learned behavior. It's picked up in the very earliest childhood in its original patterns, and we grow into a lifestyle, and it's largely affected by the kind of culture we grow up into. Whole big issue David and I have been talking all week about this disastrous decision of the state Supreme Court to allow gay marriage, when by very definition the way God designed the universe is one man and one woman together for life in a commitment to each other. That's how we're built male and female, and the differences, the complementarity of the two sexes makes all the difference in the world about this. So the main thing would be we're in a fallen world, and the body hasn't been redeemed yet. So God puts a spirit and a soul, which he's created in a body, which is generated by a biological process, and we grow up then with a fallen nature and have to begin to make choices and decisions to stay in tune with God. And so here again, accurate knowledge of God is going to be very vital if we're going to make all the right kind of choices. If we're going to be cooperating with God's plan and program, like it or not. We all have to do things we don't want to do. We all have to fight against all kinds of inclinations we have to lie, steal, cheat, hide, right? Okay.
I think you might say, well, since we're born with that sin element, we're tempted to do a lot of things. And even someone who feels they were born gay, if God shows them that celibacy is the response to that inclination, by his grace they can live that way.
Because there's
a lot of things we want to do that we become, through his spirit, convicted are not right.
Totally. Yeah. Suppose you were born a prostitute. Or you were born a thief. You want to pursue a career in how to steal. Well, those things that are socially, biblically unacceptable, you have to just say no to the temptation, to the desire, and find something that is pleasing to God. We're all fighting and struggling against things in ourselves that are contrary to what God wants. That's a big fallen, the dilemma of being in a fallen world. Thy eyes beheld my unformed substance. In thy book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. How precious to me are thy thoughts, O God! How vast is the sum of them! Now, what does that mean? If your mind is filled with the thoughts of God, then he's communicating with you. Right? And you're marveling at the things he's showing you. How do you put yourself in a position where God can put his thoughts in your mind and show you what's on his mind and on his heart? How do you get to that place? Instead of yelling or demanding, or how do you get to the place where you can say, Lord, I never had such wonderful insights as you gave me today. Thank you for all this that I'm learning. And I've been working at it a while, and you show me wonderful new things every day. Now, how's that happening? How does that happen? The Holy Spirit will reveal truth, and in order for us to hear the truth, in order for us to receive the truth or be worthy of the truth, then on our part, we have to line our lives up to be receptive, to be pleasing to God. Otherwise, he's not willing to share to us with us as intimately, right? How precious to me are thy thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. It's wonderful, inexhaustible knowledge that God has of everything, that he delights to share you with you. If I could count them, they're more than the sand. When I am awake, I am still with thee. Wake or sleep, delighted God hasn't left me. Now the fundamental break in the psalm occurs right here at verse 19. In which he suddenly stops thanking God for the just all the incredible overtones of God's omniscience and his omnipresence, and he addresses his attention toward the wicked. Now, the wicked here means all those who don't know God. It doesn't mean those that are just deliberately, openly opposed to God. It means all those who do not live a lifestyle that acceptable to God. Oh, that thou wouldst slay the wicked, O God, and that men of blood would depart from me. Now, God, this is imprecatory praying here. This is where you say, really telling God as frankly as you know how, God, would you please deal with the evil in the world? Would you please deal with the evil that is plaguing my life or my family or my friends? Would you deal with it, Lord? Again, here's this huge division between the righteous and the unrighteous that we saw in the first Psalm. He says, there are men who maliciously defy thee, who lift themselves up against thee for evil. How about people maliciously defying God today? Everywhere. Insulting God, using his name in a blasphemous way, openly defying him. Don't we have a generation around us where no one fears God? I think so.
A few generations,
yeah. Do I not hate them that hate thee, O Lord? Do I not loathe them that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them my enemies. How does that fit in with loving your enemies and praying for those who persecute you? Is that consistent? We're getting near the end of the psalm, so you got 15 minutes of comments to come up with.
Well, I'm stuck in one area, and I guess what keeps coming out to me in this psalm is verse 5, you hem me in and behind and before, you have laid your hand upon me, and I got stuck with his hands on us. And then in 10, even there, your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. And then, so God is trying to guide us. He's given us our free will to choose, but he's still gently, from the beginning, guiding us. And 13 is when you created my innermost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. It takes hands to knit, right? And so back to hands again. His hands are always on us. And then in this 19, if you would only slay the wicked, how do you slay them? You got to do it with your hands. So now David's asking God to use his hands, which are loving, guiding, to do something awful, actually. But that's not the way he slays the wicked. He doesn't bring us to him that way, even though we're being against him. Look at Paul on the road. You know, he was certainly saying horrible things about Jesus and God through the first part of his life. And yet, how did God bring him to his attention?
Well, of course, it's anthropomorphic here that God would say that his hand is doing something. It means his power. I was thinking a while ago, if you ask God's hand to guide you, an arm isn't going to materialize out of empty space and go. It would scare the heck out of you.
It did once when the hand was writing on the wall.
The handwriting on the wall was bad enough, yeah. No, these are beautiful ways of saying in human terms the many ways that God has of doing things that are beautiful, holy, just, acceptable, a whole variety of things.
But how do we as Christians, because the example we have is Jesus hanging on the cross saying, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And yet here we have really this troublesome set of verses that seems to contradict that.
Yeah, that's great. We need more comments out of this. God's exasperated, I think. I mean, David's exasperated. He's frustrated, and he's crying out of the honesty of his heart. This is how I really feel, Lord David.
Yes, and I felt that way for a very, very long time. My question is, when he says, oh, that you would slay the wicked, are we talking the wicked meaning a collective body, a literal collective body of individuals who, like the Canaanites, who were completely bent and set in their ways against God? Or are we talking about more of a personification of a concept, wicked actions, wicked behavior, wicked intent, parallel to some of it says, as opposed to this person is evil, rather what they do is evil, kind of evil being a more abstract. Is it talking in that terms?
Well, I don't know. That's a great question, isn't
slay
it?
Slay the wicked, meaning slay the evil, destroy the wicked.
Are we talking about evil people, evil individuals? Or are we talking about some collective kind of evil?
I didn't tell David if you ask too hard a question, you have to answer it. So.
Yeah.
Slay the evil? Is that temptation?
No, I thought you had
it. Well, I mean, is that temptation? Is that what the evil is? That slay the wicked, oh Lord, this temptation that's always after them. I mean, that's the evil in our life that is always tempting us to go the other way. So, away from me,
you bloodthirsty men. That's a very good question. Here we got a good answer.
I think we lose track of the fact that God identifies with our heart, not with our bodies. So when he talks in here about slaying the wicked, he's going to slay the body because the body is temporary. But our souls are eternal, and he's not slaying our souls. It's the body that dies, and we identify with the wrong thing when we're identifying with the temporary.
I think that's great. Yeah, that's great.
Would you mind if we switch the subject a little bit? Back on the subject of the gays issue, just so that it's said within the church. I have that within the church there might be different points of view. I have a friend who is gay, and his heart is good. And I guess for me, I've been trying to how do I describe this? Trying to figure out how to walk and accept at the same time. I've heard of people who are speakers in women's retreats who had said that they had a son that was gay, and she judged him, and they had no relationship for a very, maybe over a decade. And to me, it still comes down to, no matter what time we have in history, there's always a group that you judge. I don't know where gays fit in here, but I do believe that God has a plan, and they were meant to be a part of that plan. Then I go back to the fact that in the Lord's Prayer, we talk about forgive us our transgressions as we would like to be forgiven also. That basically we're all sinners. And as far as I'm concerned, gays, I don't care who you are, so long as you're a good person at heart with me, I will treat you, as best as I can. So to me, the Prop 8 is a loaded dice. There's no real good answer to it, but I just wanted to say within the church, I wanted to say it because I think I felt a little bit scared to say it because the group is very much, gays are wrong and that's that. But I wanted to say that, there has to be some sort of acceptance because it's got to be in God's plan somehow.
So I think Psalm 1 dealt with this fundamental polarity in life. There are righteous. The righteous are people who were sinners to the core, and they have been acquitted by their faith in Jesus Christ and reborn and given a new nature. If anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. So a Christian is new on the inside and therefore fundamentally different on the inside from the non-Christian. Part two would be, as followers of Jesus, we have to live lifestyles that are consistent with what God asks of all Christians. Yeah, I have a wonderful book on the changes going on in the culture right now in the area of sexuality and traditions. It's a very enlightening book. No matter how much the world changes around us, the standards for God's people are the same. And we have to live that way no matter what, and be loving and caring and compassionate, but not compromising. And we have to insist that within our sphere of influence, this is these are the agreed upon biblical standards by which we live, no matter what. And if you once get that line established, that line of separation, then we're in the position of reconciling people to God and persuading them to come into the family. A whole year ago, David and I had this seminar at PBC Cupertino in which a gay man and his lover wanted to become members of the church. And we discussed it at great length, round and round and round, and he was treated with great love and great respect, and everybody was compassionate and understanding. But the bottom line was, well, look, here are the biblical standards for how we are supposed to behave, so that's what we're going to do. You're welcome to come here at any time. We'll talk to you, but you're not one of us in the inner core because you don't have a relationship with Jesus yet. Now, this is tearing whole churches apart right now, and it goes all the way up into the clergy, which says that the church as a whole doesn't have a unified biblical worldview anymore, to me. But we're part of it. We're part of those overcomers in the church. We're part of the real church embedded in the big church. We have to live biblically, I think. It's a whole subject in itself.
Whoa, we just lit up.
Well, we'll spend the next 2 hours on it.
I just want to respond to ask Christians react basically two things. One is love, and the other is judgment. Love is not without judgment. So, as we go on in our lives, we live our lives supposedly to obey God's commandments, to live in the realm of His righteousness. And we try to repent ourselves and conform to God and His commandments. But on the other hand, when there are gays around, we are called to love them. We can't just entertain with them. We can't just fellowship with them freely, We have to be careful. Love them, yes. But at the same time, it's our duty to say, hey, the gays just can't go to heaven, period. But what they have to do is to agree with God and the Word. Gays cannot simply go to heaven, because it says so in the Bible.
The hypocrisy in the church is pretty evident to gays and to outsiders. The behavior of heterosexuals in the church has not been all that great. Same divorce rate, same failure rate, same immorality rate. So the church is tremendously hypocritical. Not the real church within the church, but the professing church. And that's part of the problem. The church has to have a consistent position on all areas of sexual conduct. And we've lost that over a long period of time. Look at how this psalmist closes here in verse 23. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. Test my motives. Help me to know myself and why I'm acting this way and why I'm doing this. Compare me constantly with what your standards are. See if there is any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. This is a plea that this psalmist could walk close to Jesus in harmony with Jesus. We don't know ourselves very well, learning and growing and becoming more holy. which is, this word puts it right down onto our individual lives and our individual conduct. And the big picture, God alone can handle. Big picture is the sea of confusion. You can't look to a church now to be a beacon in the community of what's right and wrong, because the church, in by and large, is not that anymore. But within the church, there's a remnant. This is the remnant here. People down the street, I don't think there's any other remnants in Palo Alto. This is it.
You know, we have to be careful, because the Lord showed Paul in Corinth that he had a whole bunch more people.
Oh, that's I forgot. Anyway, maybe there's a couple more comments that I'm missing.
Well, I did want to add, Victoria will go next, but it's interesting, I think it's verse 19, that David ultimately is trusting the Lord to execute David.
Yes. Yeah.
We have discernment, perhaps, but we're not the ones ultimately passing judgment. And I think we're careful not to rank other people's sin as worse than our own in general. Is hopefully keep us out of trouble when we say, Lord, what in my life is lacking? Let me go back to Victoria and stop right now.
Well, I hope I can address both the homosexual question and also the verse 19. What I want to say is that I'm sure that as Christians we can agree, or at least we should, that homosexuality is considered by God a wickedness. I mean, even Paul himself addressed it in Romans. And we need to, as Christians, we need to be careful not to fall into those worldly traps under the categories of being tolerant. You know, I know that, and this is a big subject, but we do what we can fall into that. And sometimes we can do that by also, as Cynthia over there said, that her friend is good, or has a good heart. And even in the Bible, you know, Jesus himself said, you know, that no one is good but him. So we need to see sin for what it is. And maybe that should kind of cover it. So here's Maria.
Maria?
Sure. I rent my place for people from time to time, renting the room. One time, I rented to a girl who would like to sleep in the van and sleep with her. I love her very much, and I told her, you know, you are a very good roommate. I almost give you 100% for you being so good a roommate, but I give you 99.999. So one night, a man slipped in and wanted to sleep with her through the night. At that time, I just said to myself, you know, I need the power and authority of God to do the right thing. So I pray about it. So I asked the man to come out from the bedroom. If not, the girl will have to move out tomorrow. And I pray God will give me the power and authority to do the right thing. As a Christian, we have to know what is right and what is wrong. And God give me that authority, and the man move get out that night. I think that I also practice it with children, that I said, God, you have given me power and authority, not out of judgment, but out of love, and to do the right thing, because I'm your child, I have to give the testimony how we should live.
Thank you. I'm sorry, we need to close. Boy, we could have used the extra time, but the new format will avail to us. Cynthia, would you lead us as we close? Thank you, Lambert. I'm surprised we haven't sung this one yet. So.
I think it's the 14th, my God, and we sing on the day when it's a call to time. And it's huge.
When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like
Spirit, and that we would exhibit the love of Christ in all that we do. In Jesus' name.
Amen.